All right. I've got two returning friends, guests. Chong, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good as always. And Professor Fred, what's going on?
How's it going, everybody? It's great to be here.
Actually, you should call you both professors. But yeah, no. Last time we convened was in the beginning of the summer, right? Or like right prior. And
yeah.
we had that Korean food at what was the place called?
Hojokban.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah, that was nice. That was beginning of summer, and then I was like, I'd like to do like, because Fred and I think we've done like two pods where we discussed Byung-Chul Han's Burnout Society, and then another one. What was it? It was the one about shitlibs.
Yeah, PMC. Virtue Hoarders, Catherine Liu.
Catherine Liu's Virtue Hoarders, right? Yeah. Right, yeah. And both like really small, sort of pamphlet sized, you know, books. And then to sort of intro what I wanted to, I kind of want to just hear you two talk about it just because you're both humanities scholars and, you know, I just want to know what a proper academic discussion of this book is because someone on Twitter had tweeted this phrase, men without chests, and that caught my attention because it just seemed like a strange phrase, but also at the same time relevant to sort of like, This ongoing discussion about a masculinity crisis and what's wrong with boys and maybe what's wrong with people generally. And, you know, I don't know the scope and necessarily the content of like the discussion out there about that. But men without chests was an interesting phrase, and it was attributed to C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, which is a 3-chapter work, which is very short, almost pamphlet-sized, kind of going with this, like, low-overhead book club vibe I'm trying to go for here. And so we've all read this book. It might have been some time. It's been some time since I've read it, maybe a few months. So I'm not – it's not all in my head. I skimmed it real quick again today. But, okay, so that's the intro. I don't know if either of you Chong, you had said in the emails that were going back and forth, because I had cited like this article that said that religiosity among young people is kind of going really high, especially young, and then you mentioned that it's higher among young men.
Yeah,
and so I just was curious whether that was linked at all to what was being discussed.
So, yeah, I read it some time ago. I also skimmed it. I think, you know, and I was sort of looking up some stuff online, and this text gets used a lot in men Bible study, right? So I can kind of see why. It, to me, it's a text that's all about being aggrieved. I can see a group of aggrieved men sitting around and reading this as a sort of example of why teachers are not doing their job, why young boys are, you know, they're being told to talk about their feelings and to trust their own feelings, and they're not learning anything objective. They're not learning what's good. They're not being told how to behave. They're not being told right from wrong. So it seems a sort of dated argument, because I feel that these questions in education were talked about kind of in the early 90s when there was this backlash against, you know, so-called girl-centered education. There were all these psychologists and educational psychologists writing texts and studying like what's wrong with boys. We sort of left them behind,
you know. Oh, in the 90s even.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, that sounds 90s. So current. That sounds, yeah, so no. Current. And as if it was I think people, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but like that's surprising to me that you say that because when I hear it now, it's couched by someone like, who's the NYU, like Scott Galloway, you know, someone like that who talks a lot about this, as if it's a very timely thing that's happening now. Mm-hmm. And
no.
Yeah.
Those books were old. What, Fred, maybe you remember the name of it. It was a very famous book. It was called something like We're Leaving Boys Behind. And yeah, it was late 90s. And this, of course, kind of coincided with the school shootings and male entitlement, male aggrievement, that schools have headed so far in the opposite direction. All the books are about little girls. They can be whatever they want to be. They can be superheroes now. And yeah, so I feel that this has come around again. And so I like the text. I think there's a lot of interesting philosophical statements in here, but I do think it is a little thin to me. I didn't feel when I read it that I was reading something super profound. I just feel it's very simple that we're telling people to, like in education, we're telling people to trust their own feelings and experiences too much when we should be really guiding them more with truth, which, okay, fine. But yeah.
Which interesting, he chooses the term Tao or Dao, the Chinese term, which I thought was, I didn't expect that, but
yeah.
It's weird.
So I think I had a more favorable reaction, but let me say a few things. I'm generally on the left, if we're going to use conventional left-right terms, but I do enjoy a good conservative to right-wing argument. And I think this is a conservative argument having to do with the, he calls it the traditional value system, but we could also say traditional humanistic inquiry. That and then we have to say who's tradition and all this. It's clear to me that they're is a not exclusively European, but, you know, because as Tien just pointed out, there's, you know, this whole thing about Tao as the ultimate source of values, you know, which usually, or sorry, this is, I'll just say this in terms of my expectations. I thought he was going to say God, you know, because by reputation, he's a Christian thinker and Narnia is supposed to be this extended allegory about Christ or something along those lines. I haven't actually read it, but okay. So I do think going back to the 90s, as Chung was suggesting, is an important move because these kinds of arguments are cyclical and kind of perennial. That's one thing I think this shows. So this was written in the 60s. It's written in the 60s, I believe. But a lot of the resonances with the 90s, well, are we preserving the canon, for example, in literary studies? Are we preserving the canon in philosophy? Are we transmitting the same values from, for lack of a better term, European civilization? Something along these lines. Those are huge, huge debates, and now they're, you know, culture wars. We call them culture war debates, but back then they were largely in the academic scene discussed in terms of canon wars, you know, and one line of reform / attack of the canon idea was kind of multicultural education or, you know, multi-ethnic lit, I think they called it. In literary studies, there was also feminist critiques of the canon, like why is it all guys? You know, why is it all men? Okay, so I can see the appeal of this book for, you know, mostly male Bible study groups or aggrieved young men. I get that. I'm not sure they're getting it, though. And this often is the case when, you know, people pick up books because something sounds good or sounds appealing in it. And then they sort of get what they need out of the book. It's, you know, it's a highly motivated reading. And I kind of think that's going on with this Men Without Chests thing. I kind of think he's, so like, I actually like think the back of this book describes the argument better than some of the usages I've seen of it. Cause it basically says C.S. Lewis is trying to persuade the audience of the importance of universal values such as courage and honor in a contemporary society. The some of the links that Teen sent earlier actually had to do with this other very interesting West-East connection or West-East issue, which is there was somebody online, I forget the name of the authors because it was months ago, who was basically saying U.S. allies in East Asia had been turned into men without chests. And I think they were talking about Japan, probably Taiwan, South Korea. Okay, and so their sense of being, I would guess, emasculated or somehow not seen as endowed with manhood or something along those lines. I don't know if they've got C.S. Lewis exactly right, because the way I was reading it, this "Men Without Chests" line. He reads Plato. He basically says in Plato's Theory of the Soul, and I'm sorry if this is getting a little too technical or nerding out or whatever, but there's the rational element, there's the spirited element, and then there's the desiring element or the appetitive element. Okay, and this is supposed to be like this hierarchy among the soul. And C.S. Lewis is saying, you forgot about that spirited element. You forgot about the source in our psychology of being courageous. You forgot about why anyone would want to sacrifice themselves to protect their family or society. You forgot about, what is the other one? Honor. You forgot about your sense of honor and shame. You're just shameless and all this. Like, you lost that part of your soul somehow. And when he's going on and on about this textbook that he hates, the way I'm reading that, what he's saying is this textbook writer basically thinks there are only two parts of the soul. There's reason and then there's desire. Okay, he totally forgot about the middle part, the part about courage and honor and all that.
He said, because I think the part, I just reread that part, so it's kind of fresh in my mind, but I think he was saying there's the thinking and the desiring, which is,
exactly.
He located that in the belly, so the chest is just sort of anatomically in the middle, and said that they're not connected, he's saying that the product of modern education and the kind of books that he was referencing in this critique of his of educational texts of the day was that it failed to make a connection between the two, thus there's no chest, is what he
yes.
He didn't mean it like scrawny chest, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. He didn't mean go out and do a bunch of push-ups, eat creatine, and spend a lot of weight.
He says he didn't mean it that way, but I think he meant it that way. Because he actually uses the word gelding later, right? He says you want people, like, we educate young men and tell them to be, you know, innovative, courageous, heroic, but we've gelded them. So he's that saying mean? That they have no balls. I think there is an element, I think. What's that? Sorry?
It's what they do to horses, right? Castrate horses.
Yeah. He's saying they're castrated. And so he backs off the idea that, or maybe he doesn't back off the idea, but I think there is an element here of emasculation, no? With the gelding. Mm.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
So sorry, now I'm trying to rethink what I was saying.
Because
this is great because I was taking him too much at his word. You know, there's other parts where he says we need to transmit along with traditional values manhood. You know, and I think he means manhood, and I think he's thinking about the education of young English, you know, boys and the like.
So the text is the text, but I think the issue that it, like, what it connects to today, to me, is very interesting because it is. I think it's relevant to today. Like, it's like the first chapter, the first of three chapters. When I read it, I was like, this is an old English guy's anti-woke critique. There's many ways in which this sounds a lot like a proto version of the anti-woke discussion now, saying like, the sort of spirit of the academic tradition has been destroyed in favor of, of this sort of like, I don't even know what to, he never really gives the thing that he's criticizing a name, but I feel like it has to do with the sort of like deracination of, you know, just the deracination of education, right? Like, yeah, stepping away from core books, core texts and things like that, core ideas, and moving into this new world of critical theory, or, you know, like sort of, ironically, maybe not ironically, but like self-consciously attacking a lot of the assumptions of our culture or whatever. Okay. I guess for me, I was just thinking about this today. Like, his point. Okay. So in the first chapter, he talks about how the texts are sort of deconstructing or like undercutting the idea of like heroic thinking, not male valor, but male valor, right? That kind of thing. But in today's context, and this is a problem that I see, is like, we're all living like pretty prosaic lives, right? Like, we aren't swashbucklers. We're not fucking, you know, like, we're going to work in an office and we're going to work a job and, you know, we're going to have like financial goals that bother us, all, you know, like, we're gonna lead modern prosaic lives. And I was like, is there something there to the idea that therefore education is preparing us for this prosaic kind of life and is morphing into job training or whatever, and there's no room for, you know, the heroic ideas of the past? So I don't know. That was just in my head, but Chong, any thoughts there? I'm curious what you think about this.
Well, I think the idea that, what's missing from the book or the type of education that he's critiquing is that no one's trying to instill core values in the children. So when they're reading literature, when they're observing a painting, they're just being asked to react to it, you know, to trust their own subjective opinion. And I don't think there's anything wrong with what he's saying. I tend to agree. The issue where I come in is, of course, you know, whose values, which ones, and then all of this kind of proto anti-woke critique of education is that it sort of misses the reality that even in the times of the people who he would probably consider like European universal humanist values, they were also not considered universal for their time. Most of them were outliers, outcasts. Some of them were even burned at the stake. So you have to look at the sort of Western tradition, civilization, which a lot of schools are going back to, by the way. A lot of colleges are really like the resurgence of a core curriculum. But with that in mind, right? Without saying like, this is the core curriculum. It's just saying this is a core curriculum that everyone else at one point that you're reading also new. And I think that's the way I would approach it too, is just say like, yes, this is important because the people that you're reading are have read it. They will have read it and they knew it. So you should know it so you can know what they read. So yeah, that's kind of my take on it, is that he does present these four different, you know, philosophies. I don't know, Aristotle, the Tao, even Saint Augustine, and to me, that itself is a core curriculum. He's sort of teaching you, right? He's looking at these four different ways. So when you're reading this and you're saying, you're reading his critique of education, but then he goes and gives you a core, right? He gives you these other philosophers. And so you're sort of participating in the action that he's setting up, which that part of it I thought was interesting. That I liked a lot.
So quick reaction. I think his reference to Tao is kind of, it kind of goes in line with what you're saying, because Taoism, from my understanding, is actually sort of like a countercultural force in China. So if you feel too penned in by Confucian, the strictness of Confucian society or whatever, Taoism is sort of a method of like in sort of escape and being free of these of Confucianism, of like, you know, the sort of like rigorous social orders of the day. So citing Tao to me, I don't know if it's like sort of a misunderstanding. Maybe I have the misunderstanding. I don't know. But yeah, I didn't really interpret Tao the same way he did. But maybe he's using it. Again, I think he's using Tao. He's using a sort of like a multicultural approach to what he really wants to say, is that they need to reinstate more organized Christianity and have it closer, you know, more pertinent to the state, which I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I think that is what he's saying. And there's I sense a self-consciousness or self-awareness that he shouldn't say that too directly. And therefore I'll use Tao as a way to move my target, you know, a little further away from what I really mean. I don't know.
So on the Tao bit, you know, I think there are many ways of interpreting what Taoism is about. Like the Tao Te Ching is the Lao Tzu, it's the other name for it, is sometimes interpreted as a advice to king kind of book. So it's actually a philosophy of governing, in the same way that Confucianism is a philosophy of governing. So you sort of take the form of government for granted, and then you try and get the right kind of character into the seat of power. That's one way of interpreting it. Zhuangzi, which is a later work in the same Taoist canon, that's where the countercultural stuff comes in. That's where Confucius shows up, and he's kind of respected, but, you know, he's a bit of a rules, follow the rules and follow the rights kind of guy. And okay, so I do think that C.S. Lewis's interpretation of the Tao is much closer to the good order. Tao is the source of all values, and that's why our values are not arbitrary, either in a cultural sense or just how an individual idiosyncratically feels. Which, of course, is exactly what the anti-woke people claim woke people believe about values. So they've got this whole right-wing narrative about how critical race theory, feminism, Marxism, deconstruction, all of that, postmodernism, is value relativistic, either in reducing all values to just what you're appetites say, you know, that lowest part of your belly says, right? Or to this idea that values are socially constructed and there's no reason we should prefer these values to those values. So I definitely think he's got a sort of strange interpretation of Tao, because at certain points he even swaps it out for the natural law tradition. And he says, well, just like John Locke says you shouldn't harm others. That's part of the Tao in the expansive sense. You see what I'm saying? So like, he makes it a sort of law and order thing when in, you know, at least there's a well-established tradition of reading Taoism as more a sort of act naturally and spontaneously. Don't think too hard about these social conventions, you know, the kind of more libertarian or more countercultural way of reading Taoism. So that's my first, my first point. My second point has to do with, I think there is a question here around if we accept, and this is what C.S. Lewis is arguing, that traditional values, we have to assume that they are not man-made. We have to assume that they come from something outside of humanity. You know, it's not just our guts telling us that the waterfall is sublime. It's not just our guts saying the Sistine Chapel is beautiful. You know, it's not that. There's more than that. There's a sort of objective source of the values. Then you run into this very difficult question of what are the actual values? And wouldn't it be rather coincidental that one tradition written in one language and maybe a couple other, Greek and Latin or something, is at the core of these, has more of an insight into those values and the like. So I don't know if the ethnocentrism or Eurocentrism charge can entirely be escaped. And I would bring up just one example of this. He says, in the Analects, Confucius says, don't do unto others what you don't want done to you. And then he says, Christianity improves on the idea. Because anyone who accepts don't do to others what you don't want done to you should be able to see the logical extension of do unto others as you would have done unto them. And so his example of how the Tao is expanded has this kind of, well, the East had some inklings, but then the West sort of fulfilled it or brought it to fruition and so forth. So that's the other bit I would point out. And then of course, if we're going to go all the way with this line of thinking, why is it only the East and the West have anything to contribute to the Tao? Do you know what I mean? Like, what about Africa? What about Indigenous America? What about other parts of, Indigenous Australia, Aboriginals in Australia? You know, what about that? Don't they have something to say? Well, no, well, they don't have written traditions and written canons, so they don't have anything to say. That doesn't make any sense to me. You know, that
they don't have a large state religion that I can point to.
So
I like that too. Looking at the different sayings, do unto others and looking at them in different cultures to think somehow that one was improved upon or one goes a step further, because it reminded me of, I don't know, traveling through Europe a long time ago, 20, 30 years ago, and seeing on a German train, you know, you're not supposed to drink the water. So it just says in German, like, kein Trinkwasser, which is like not drinking water. But in America, you'd have to be told, like, don't drink the water. Whereas the Germans are like, this is not drinking water. Okay, well, I'm not going to drink it then because I'm not an idiot. But here you have to tell you, like, don't drink the water. So there's probably other examples like that. It's like how much do the people need to be told explicitly something? For how many people is a simple cup with a line through it that says no? Or do you have to say, do not, this isn't? So yeah, I actually like that about him. And I think that shows a little bit of it, that in and of itself is... you know, you all want the same goal. Like, you don't want to drink this bad water, but you have different ways of achieving it, different ways of telling people. And you don't know why, but just one works in one culture and one doesn't. So I think so long as you don't judge, it is just a part of being human and sharing the planet among people who have, you know, different ways of life, different views, blah, blah, and not believing one is superior, as he might have in his way of saying that one improves the other. But that's that. Yeah, that reminded me of that, of the drinking water in the train.
I mean, I definitely think he should be given credit for looking beyond what he's familiar with. And, you know, I don't think he was being taught Taoism when he was a schoolboy. You know what I mean? So, like, then again, it was also the 60s, you know?
Right.
And a lot of people were looking, a lot of people in these parts were looking what, you know, they called East.
Yeah.
The Zen stuff, the Taoist stuff.
I mean, from that angle, then maybe what he's doing, if you take that into account, is to say, whatever you think you're going to find through this eclecticism, you're going to end up back here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like you're looking for new sources of truth, but there's only one source.
I think this is a very interesting question because, if we set aside the what about people without these literary traditions and canons, and again, I think that's a legitimate concern, totally legit. I do think he's very interested in basically saying humanity is one. You know, this is old school humanism, and maybe we approach it through different literary traditions, but aren't they all saying basically the same thing? Now, if you actually start with more of a, well, actually there's quite substantial cultural differences and quite substantial linguistic differences and quite substantial philosophical starting points and so forth. Well, then of course you can find the differences if that's, you know what I mean? If that's your goal, obviously there's huge differences between Taoism and Christianity, you know, like, okay. But if your goal is to say, you know, humanity is one and really all these traditions are kind of saying the same thing, I might as well call it Tao. I don't have to call it natural law. And I appreciate that gesture as well. And he didn't say we all basically have the same idea of God. He said we all basically have the same idea of Tao. So, I do give him credit for that. And sorry, one more thing and then I'll be quiet. But I tend to think conservatives often have their finger on real problems, but I really can never buy their solutions. And for me, although this is very interesting, Chong, I think your point about how a lot of universities return to core curriculums, but after the canon wars, after the culture wars, and now they're not saying this is like the repository of all objective values, but they're basically saying, look, why don't we have a reading list in common so we have something to talk about? I'm totally fine with that. Completely fine with that. And if Europeanists want to have one of those, they can make their own. If there's a different reading list for African-American studies, if there's a different reading list for science and technology studies, if there's different reading for feminist studies. So that, I think, is a feasible way of actually doing some of what Lewis would like. But can you actually preserve, I don't know, Coleridge and Wordsworth or whatever, and let's all your English department teach it? No, that's done. Nobody's going to do that. And students, you think the enrollment, you know, troubles now.
Yeah.
Nobody enrolled in that. So that's kind of what I mean by, like, there are some real problems here. And I do believe that part of the reason that so many young men, Christian nationalists and others, are going for this, Jordan Peterson's another one, they go for Jordan Peterson, is because they think their education is just this dry, technical, let me get grades thing. They think that, according to the social scientists, that, you know, your values are just preferences, market preferences, or like biological urges, that, you know, there's no real such thing as value. You know, that's kind of what Lewis was saying about these textbook writers for this, I believe it was a grammar textbook or something. It was like,
yeah,
something for K through 12. What we have is K through 12, I believe. And so people feel like a sort of education isn't helping me see the bigger picture, isn't helping me live a meaningful life, isn't helping me, you know, think about how I can live a better life, you know, and therefore I go after C.S. Lewis or Jordan Peterson or someone who in the name of tradition can actually tell me what this is all about and why I'm not just, you know, a sack of flesh getting up every morning and, you know, going to class. So I think that's a real problem, in other words. And I think that's why people are drawn to this. I just don't.
Yeah. The quote that I noted down that I thought was really effective, the task of the modern educator is not to cut down jungles, but to irrigate deserts. I forgot where that was. But yeah, you know, he's just referring to, like, these students don't have anything anyway. So really they're in some ways empty vessels, and it's your job to cultivate something in them, which, sure, I mean, you see that more and more, particularly now with students really because of market forces, because of the economic situation that everybody's in. Yeah, they do just need the credentials. So, but you know, how did this text, which is a lot more complex, a lot more complicated, how does it get taken as a, by these, you know, right-wing Bible study men that are saying, yeah, this guy's on our side. He's basically saying that boys are being educated like little sissies, and they're playing around with finger paint, and they're talking about their feelings, and they're not being told that there is something concrete and objective out there that they should be learning. You know, it. You're right. I mean, they miss the point so often, and that's also my frustration with that. And it's like every student that I've ever had in my class, if I've ever had, I've had a few conservative students, right? Like quite a few, and we have great discussions, and these students are very smart, but somewhere along the line, there's always something that they just don't, I don't know, they have the right, like we're both looking at the same text, but I can't manage to convince them that the outcome, like the way they want to go about solving the problem is just wrong, right? It's just wrong.
What is that? What is their general bent on that? Like where, what are they thinking is the solution?
Well, I mean, a while ago, there was one. So it was an essay on economics. Something about how soccer teams in Europe, which are very different from here, the top teams have the most money and they always win. Whereas here, the Yankees don't always win. Right? It might be a team in the middle of nowhere, Kansas City or something, might win. So their solution is like, socialism is really bad and horrible, except for sports. So stuff like that, right? It's stuff that just doesn't, I don't know. I think part of it is just being in America and having years of indoctrination against the word socialism, when they're actually arguing like, yes, you're right, it should be more fair. Okay, well, let's apply that to healthcare. Not so fast, right? So it's always like they're almost getting it, but then... Yeah.
So I'm wondering what is your tack in situations like that? Do you just kind of try and read the article or the text another way and show that it can be read another way, or do you argue with them? Do you challenge them a little?
Yeah, I mean, I try to be like Socrates. I try to do the Socratic method. So, what would you say if? How do you explain this? How do you explain that? So why do you think it's better that soccer teams should have a more equitable distribution, but you don't feel that about childhood education and healthcare? And then that's when you get, well, so yeah, I mean, I even just think, applying the same principle in different situations. But yeah, I do a lot of like the Socratic method. It's like the oldest one in the book, but it's the way that you tell them, like, you know, you have to question everything. Question everything. You're almost there. You can't apply what we just said to something like a life or death situation. And that's when, you know, I don't know. Who knows?
So I think Lewis would be on board with this. One, because it's Socratic. Two, because, you know, the whole goal of Socratic dialogue is to get clear on values.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what the Republic is about, the one he keeps quoting from. It's about what is justice, basically, you know, what is fairness, you know, in this case of the soccer teams. So that I actually am fully on board with. I don't think you need to do it with Socrates. I think you could, you know, look at other traditions or even like movies. Like you can do, this is the great thing. You can think in relation to almost anything. Like seriously, like the signs in German. Or, you know, the analects of Confucius. You could think about anything. Like, it's how you approach something that makes it kind of thoughtful and philosophical. So, but, you know, where I'm really on board with this is I don't think values or discussion of values can be excluded from the classroom. And this is what are basically highly secularized and highly, let's not get sued, because when we start talking about values, we often start talking about religion. And we talk about religion, we start talking about, you know, people who don't want evolution taught or who don't want to hear anything that contradicts their literalist interpretation of the Bible, or you can keep going along these directions. And so one way of just avoiding that whole realm of value commitment and value transmission and value inquiry is to say, fine, we just do the, I don't know, we just talk facts, or we just talk science, or we just talk, and you know, these are very typical responses in the social sciences. I don't know what's going on in literary studies, you know, whether there's still talk of values and this kind of thing. But certainly that's the aspiration in social science. You hear this all the time. I don't tell them what to think. I teach them how to think, like things like that, you know, which means like the teacher and the student are both being conceived as sort of, sorry, the teacher at least has got to be non-committal with regards to what's good, what's bad, what's better and what's worse. Does that make sense?
Right. So a focus on methodology overall.
Yeah. Yeah. Method or technique, or, you know, sometimes just following directions, like how to run statistical analysis, you know, that kind of teaching. And my thought is that's exactly why school for many, and I don't know if this is particularly severe in boys, I suspect it is, you know, and this goes back to some of those studies you were citing earlier, Chung, and I'm sorry, I don't know the names of them, but I've heard of this stuff. Like, why are young men doing so much worse in college, for example, than young women? You know, and this is like a big thing. Okay, but my thought would be a lot of them are disengaged because they aren't grappling with what they consider the most important questions, which for some of them, and I think this is an interesting question as to why they feel this way, means how to be a man and how to mature in a masculine way, something like that. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I think a lot of the discourse around manliness is frankly, you know, it's just drink creatine. it's kind of immature, right. You know what I mean? Like,
Get a raptor.
Yeah, yeah. But I do think it's interesting that so many men are experiencing this very sort of transitional and crisis-ridden time. Like, they think that the most important thing for them right now is to figure out their masculinity.
You know,
some of them do. Am I right there?
Yeah, let me... I think I'm a little bit more manospheric than you, in a way. I'm more, in the sense that I think I'm a little more familiar, and even the roots of this pod are coming out of the murky depths of online spaces where the manosphere, I think that's a really interesting word, sphere, because it is a sort of world unto itself. There's a part, I'm going to just, this is relevant to your question, Fred, I think. But there's an aspect to the manospheric ways, you know, of like a Joe Rogan or something, that I think sometimes is underappreciated, because it's not all about, in my opinion, masculinity in the sense of like establishing a sort of like territorial sexual domain kind of thing, but, you know, like an Andrew Tate style kind of thing. I'm reading from page 70, and he says, you know, something has to be overcome before we can cut. It doesn't seem relevant, but I'll make the connection. Something has to be overcome before we can cut up a dead man or a live animal in a dissecting room. A similar price is exacted for our analytical knowledge and manipulative power, even if we have ceased to count it. We do not look at trees either as dryads or as beautiful objects while we cut them down into beams. The stars lost their divinity as astronomy developed, and the dying god has no place in chemical agriculture. But that is not the whole story. It is not the greatest of modern scientists who feel most sure that the object, stripped of its qualitative properties and reduced to mere quantity, is wholly real. Little scientists and little unscientific followers of science may think so. The great minds know very well that the object so treated is an artificial abstraction, that something of its reality has been lost. So I guess I just bring that up because, like you said, just the facts, right? Like, there's one approach, which is like, let's not wade into controversy and stick to just objective fact. And I think that that tendency does, it kind of makes us live in a cut down forest in a little way, where there is, I think, something inherent to, I can say that, I will put a little gender observation here. I feel like it's boys that are like most interested in supernatural shit. That I don't know if that's true or not. I just get that feeling that it's mostly boys that are into like UFOs and weird conspiracy theories and all this stuff. And that's a manosphere type thing. And okay. I get the feeling that it's somehow important and maybe taken for granted in like the total history of mankind, that there is a frontier of knowledge. Like, we only know so much, and we take it for granted that we all know that beyond this, like, we don't know much. And after that is like myth and, you know, cool stories that we use to explain shit we don't understand. It's something that I am sure, I'm not saying girls don't enjoy that, I just don't know. I know boys really fucking enjoy that stuff. I enjoy it still. And the intrusion of academic, not like scientific knowledge, into all spheres of knowledge, like not just hard science and chemistry, but also now economics, sociology, even knowing ourselves, and, you know, everything. Everywhere you look, any direction, in or out, there's no longer a frontier of knowledge. It seems like everything is known, and we're all reduced to laymen in everything, right? There's an expert that has gone far beyond what we can see, or let's say are allowed to see. And so I think part of the manosphere's culture is this sort of like interest in the occult, in the UFOs, in weird historical conspiracies and all that stuff, simply to recreate that almost bonding experience where we will sit around and go to the frontier of what we know and start telling stories to each other. I don't know if that makes sense to you, Fred, but I do feel when I read that was pointing at this tendency by not just education, but the way educated people, quote, educated people talk, mm-hmm. which is to shut everyone up because you don't know anything. You don't have you really don't have the right, like, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about, you know, all this stuff. And maybe they don't, but at the same time, it kills off that sort of sense of wonder that I think is very important for male bonding, to be honest, in a good way, I think.
Chung, do you have thoughts here?
You might be on mute.
Oh, no. When you said that we're all laymen and there's few experts, you don't think everyone thinks they're an expert now, though, conversely, with the internet? Like, almost everything is known. And I'm thinking of it just from the humanities. I'm not sure about what the social scientists are, but even a film that comes out, a novel, if these boys are reading, it's like, okay, you already know the backstory. You can already read about everything to do with its production, where it was filmed. It does kind of take the wonder out of it. You don't think
there. I think that's what I liked about this passage, was that it's the term little scientists and little unscientific followers may think so. So I think, I do think that it's people posing as experts to shut other people up because I know more than you, right? It becomes like this competitive way of I know a little bit more than you, so you should shut up, right? Whereas, and that's the little scientist. Whereas, right before that, he says, it is not the greatest of modern scientists who feel most sure that the object stripped of its qualitative properties and reduced to mere quantity is wholly real, meaning that it's the people who really know what they're talking about, the true experts, that are saying, no, there is a sense of wonder here. Like, this is really interesting. There are things, like, I'm at the frontier of knowledge, and I'm telling you, it's pretty cool here. Yeah. And, maybe that's lost. And that's why people are into the occult stuff now, you know what I mean? I think it's important. I think that is important to have a constant feeling like we do only know so much. And so that allows us to sort of imagine what's beyond that without someone immediately telling us that we're wrong,
So the way I am hooking into this concern you've raised, Teen, is around Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you all follow Jordan Peterson, but
I'm familiar with him. Yeah.
Kind of fascinated by this whole thing. It started around pronouns, and now it's around him, defending Christianity while being unable to say whether he's a Christian or not. So So my thought is, what people like about Jordan Peterson is, first of all, he's a Jungian psychoanalyst. And all I mean by that is he loves these ideas about archetypes, like there's a masculine archetype and there's a feminine archetype. And so certainly the idea that young men go on something like a hero's journey into the unknown, and yes, it's got this kind of mythic quality to it. That this is kind of Joseph Campbell Star Wars stuff on Jung. But I'm saying Jordan Peterson's got some of that. Now, what's really fascinating to me about the Jordan Peterson thing is the heroic journey for Jordan Peterson is standing up tall and cleaning your room. So he's able to infuse the most mundane and everyday activities with the sense of you're an adventuring, Perseus or who's the Homer guy? Achilles,
Odysseus.
Or something. Exactly. Odysseus, exactly. That you're on some grand journey of life. But by the way, the most important thing is actually getting your room in order. And that's actually kind of like the journey for you. So it's a way of infusing our, we have to earn money, are scientifically rational, you're living a very, safe life out in the suburbs, and maybe you're facing downward pressure and you may be pushing to the lower middle class or, working class or something. But I think it speaks to that. I think it speaks to that, which I think goes to the broader point, which is, I think, a lot of young men, and again, I'm not sure why it's young men, although empirically I believe this is the case. They feel that there's a crisis of meaning, and that in this world where nature has been reduced to this objective world that can be discerned through scientific analysis, you've taken the spirit out of it. You've desacralized it, and you don't have the sense of wonder and awe anymore, which is super important for C.S. Lewis, because you remember his whole point about the waterfall is when you see a beautiful waterfall, sublimity doesn't mean you project your feelings of greatness onto the waterfall. He says it's just the opposite. Your feeling is that you're really small and there's this wonderful, awe-inspiring, almost terrifying world out there of adventure and mystery, and you know, it's not mythic, it's mythic. And I think that's what some of these young men are looking for. Now, you know, this is not exactly, I would say, how psychologists would conceive of living a rational life. I would also say it's not how Socrates would recommend living a rational life. You don't have to be a hero. You just have to, well, maybe you do, but you just have to see the truth, you know? So, but there's certainly something going on right now where the appeal to values, the appeal to masculinity, and the appeal to tradition are all being caught up with this sort of how do we live a heroic kind of adventurous life. And I do think, sorry, I don't know what this Narnia stuff is about, but I bet some of that's in there.
Right. You know? Yeah. Well, also with a little room for unanswered questions, with a little room for uncertainty, at least if you're one of these young men and you're finding Christianity again, at least in within Christianity, it's okay, expected, and condoned to not have all the answers. So it is, yeah. You know, it's clearly a hierarchy, but you don't have to be the expert. You know, you are supposed to be the head of your family, blah, blah, blah. That's a whole other thing. But at least, yeah, there is that wonder and curiosity. I mean, at least if you go to a Catholic church where the churches are actually pretty, I don't know if you're in some of these hideous, like Protestant, they look like, I don't know, they look like malls, you know, they're so ugly. But at least, yeah, if you're in like a beautiful old church, you can stare up at the ceiling and look at the paintings and stuff and still feel that sense of wonder. Because yeah, you're, when you become a Christian, you're a child of the church, right? Like you're still a child. You have that childlike wonder. Maybe that explains some of it too, why more men than young women are turning towards religion. Because it's okay to not have all the answers. You have someone to guide you through it. You're a sheep. You don't have to be the shepherd.
There's also this bit, I think, where people of faith and, just full disclosure, I'm not one of them, say things like, God only knows. You know, I don't have to know it all.
Yeah.
And in fact, we can't. You know, so there's a sort of intellectual humility. And maybe among people who feel they've been humbled already, you know, by the world, or, you know, because they're unsure of their, of how to mature as a man or something like this. Okay. So just full cards on the table. I think, you know, some of these questions are serious and real. And I think that for young men, you know, and I can see this in some of my own students, especially students who may have not had a father figure around when they were growing up. They're actually looking for an older, in my case, I'm middle-aged, you know, mid-40s man to sort of have conversations about serious stuff that's not in the textbook and just about like their life path and this kind of thing. And so for me, you know, just pragmatically speaking, I think what we should be talking about is we have to speak to this desire that they want to be men, but we also have to, make sure that the kind of masculinity that they may be aspiring to is as mature and healthy and, you know, I'm probably saying common sense things, but, you know, I don't think it's useless gendering or whatever. I think it's speaking to a certain need among some young men who may feel really lost right now, and better we get two of them than Jordan Peterson. That's my opinion.
Well, and the numbers support everything you just said. I mean, college enrollment, there are more young women than men not only enrolled, getting degrees, not dropping out, being more successful, et cetera, et cetera. The numbers are there. So yeah, clearly it is a crisis, and I think your students are lucky to have you. I think that's nice that you're able to fulfill that role as someone who knows the material, but can also provide the stuff that C.S. Lewis is looking for. Like, okay, I want to hear a value. I don't just want to read through the text and tell you what it says. I want to know what's the truth here. And that's, I think, really an important conversation to have. Otherwise, yeah, you're just, you know, blah, blah, going through the motions.
Yeah, I think one, Fred, my experience with this is much more dude on the internet, right? Which was, I got pulled into, well, I was a fan of Reddit for a long time. Before Dig, I don't even remember this. Reddit actually used to be pretty good. And then Dig, which is another competing website. I think Chong's still on. She just muted herself. So once Dig fell apart, I think it like collapsed or something, every one of those users went over to Reddit, and Reddit started to become turn into what it is today. And the place got super fucking racist, especially... I noticed that there was just sort of an unchecked amount of racism against Asians. Like if you're, you know, they just like, you know, Ching Chong jokes and dick jokes and, you know, whatever. Right. And so I would fight with people, you know, cause I'm just like very, you know, I would just fight with people. And they, you know, I got pulled into Asian Reddit, which I've never seen before. And there was my first real intro into the manosphere. I think that the part of Asian Reddit that I got pulled into, people were asking me to go in there because they were having all these discussions about the casual racism on that was growing on Reddit. And I just saw post after post after post about dating. It was just about dating. Everything came down to that. And I got a lot of pushback with comments and stuff sort of dismissing their concerns. Not to say, I'm not just saying like it's not real, your concerns. I'm just saying it's not important. Right? And so I put a post down, like a written, like my first post, right? I wrote it down. And I said, okay, look, from the perspective of someone who's a little bit older, and actually like married and stuff. I'll make a couple observations, which is that you all seem really young. And I don't know. I mean, I know what it is. It's online porn and the degenerate culture that you're surrounded with that has got you maximally invested into hookup culture. And now at that time, I don't know what it's like now, but app culture, dating app culture, which was just a digitized form of hookup culture, right? And I was like, look, here's the thing, is like you're really young, and there are like other pillars to life that you're like really overlooking right now. And the thing is, like, the thing that you're worried about most now, a lot of it has to do with your age. Because you're a young person and you're not established, and so therefore you're not really going to be taken seriously, especially by a woman right now. You're just too young and dumb, okay? So focus instead on the other things that you should be focusing on now, which is, you know, what you're going to do with your life in terms of career and making money and that. And then two is like building, like having friends. Like, don't overlook having friends. You know, more so than just like, why don't girls pay attention to me? I'm like, you can attribute it to anything. You attribute to I'm too short, and society has an anti-short male bias, or society has an anti-Asian male bias, or I'm sure it's all true, but the reality is like, you can't focus on that right now because you're young and you've got other shit that you've got to prioritize, you know? I guess what I'm saying is like, they're coming in, these guys, as long as we're having this discussion about like what's wrong with the boys, which I think is a valid question, is like the culture is not helping them. Like the culture is pushing them in the wrong direction, and they want to grow up too fast and not put in the work. And then at the same time, and this is where I feel really bad for the young people now, is like the other stuff that like I was pointing out to be important, which is like trying to focus on developing your career and your social network, your hookup count, your body count, your whatever the fuck you want to call it, but your real social bonds that you're going to carry with you for the rest of your life, your best friends, all that, right? Harder and harder to do, from what I understand. Harder and harder to build up momentum in the beginning stages of work and career, and harder to socialize with people in a meaningful way. So that to me is like a serious headwind for the kind of things that you guys are talking about. I offer no solutions, but just to say.
That's the end of part one of a two-part podcast. Part two will be on the Patreon feed. If you want access to bonus pods, go to patreon.com/planamag.